You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 98 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And we have a special guest with us today. Worldwide traveler, voice of the people, the famous Cousin Katie.
In the house.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Wow.
Worldwide traveler.
All the way to California. And back.
I could be a callback to who, I don't remember who tweeted this, but in reference to the New York Times story about bread in LA, that the New York Times treats LA as if it's a distant planet that they're covering. So could be a callback to that. Anyway, we're going to get to Katie's trip to LA in a minute. Should we start?
I want to say we're recording a day early because I'm heading to South by Southwest in Austin this week. I was going to check out some of that Brooklyn barbecue. I hope they have some there.
New York media might be bad.
If there's anybody, if there's any listener who maybe will be at South by Southwest, they can hit me up and we can enjoy a Lone Star together.
That sounds great.
It seems unlikely that that's going to happen, but I'll enjoy the Lone Star either way.
Yeah, that's for certain. So we look forward to hearing about your adventures in Austin next week. And then 2 weeks from now, really exciting, my trip to Spokane.
Oh, you're going to Spokane?
I'm covering the women's regionals there.
The Pelton Cast is going to Spokane.
Does that mean you can go to Idaho, too, to watch? Didn't Kentucky get stuck in Idaho?
Kentucky is playing in Idaho against Arizona, yes, but I will not be in Boise for those games.
Kentucky's playing Arizona in the first round?
Well, that would be the second round matchup of both of those teams.
I have not even looked at the bracket.
You're still waiting for TBS to unveil it?
You're still hoping the Huskies make it in?
Still waiting for them to be announced.
Fingers crossed.
Which, by the way, speaking of the bracket, if you haven't done so, you should go right this second because it is live and sign up for the Pelton Cast Challenge through ESPN's Tournament Challenge.
For both the men's and the women's brackets. So we're already up to, I think, a solid like 15 or so people.
Yeah. The entries are flooding in.
That's a pretty good effort by the listener to fill it out 12 times to go along with our three entries.
I haven't filled it out yet.
No,
are you kidding?
Do you have any takes about USC here before anything else?
I thought it was exceedingly odd they didn't make it in. It seems like whatever your criteria are that you're using, USC should have been in, having finished second in the conference during the regular season.
And making it to the final in the Pac-12 tournament. Yeah.
And being competitive there. I don't know about this one. I mean, I guess they lost a lot of non-conference games.
It was very strange when I found out 3 or 4 days after the bracket was unveiled. Well, anyway, it was just another reason why the tournament should be expanded to like 128 teams.
This is the worst idea. You just have such terrible takes on this.
The NCAA tournament should be at least, what is the number, 96 teams that I want?
Do you want 32 teams to get an automatic bye to the what would be the first round?
More teams being in the tournament is good.
Having something mean something is good.
No, things meaning things is overrated.
Wait, so there'd be automatic qualifiers from each conference or no?
I don't really care. Sure. I just want more teams being in.
Wondering what problems this would fix because they would just put like entire other conferences in and then still leave the Pac-12 with two teams.
I don't know. Given the number of
two bid league.
Yeah. Given the number of teams the Pac-12 has in the NIT, I think they would have been pretty well represented in a 96.
This is why I'm for is that the Pac-12 is very good in like the 60 through 80 range.
That's not a good range.
It's not a good range, but it's where the Pac-12 lives.
Okay.
But if maybe the committee is wrong about leaving, say, USC out, they would have a chance to prove that they were wrong by being able to play.
I mean, there's always going to be someone who's going to be left out. But there's always, wherever you draw the line.
At a certain point, like, if you have that many teams and a team is left out, it's like, okay, you were like 17 and 15 this year. You've got nobody to blame but yourself. Once you get
Do you like the proliferation of bowl games? Do you feel better about bowl games because there's so many of those?
No, because I only care about playoffs. Yeah. The only thing that I care about is a team having a chance to excel to the championship.
That's what the conference tournaments are. The conference tournaments are the playoffs to the NCAA tournament.
Not the same.
Why not? If you win your conference tournament, by definition, you make the NCAA tournament.
I don't like that you're right about this argument.
except for teams that don't make their conference tournament because they don't feature every team. Remember when UW got left out of the second Pac-10 tournament? Good times.
I don't remember that.
No.
Well, that was a tough year for Dion Shooten-Luton. Anyway, what are we drinking today?
So we've moved on to the second month of Fremont's spring seasonal series. And I think very appropriate on the heels of the warmest early March day any of us could possibly remember, is it was well over 70 degrees here. The Mountain Daisy. Tell us a little about this beer. Why don't you handle
that? That's a very long description.
Okay, skip past the first part about Fremont being an independent brewery, because that's on all of these different varieties.
Okay, spring is the season of renewal and invention, and that's cool with Fremont. So we decided to offer not one, not two, but three different beers for our spring seasonal this year. Hello! Each beer will be made for 1 month from January through March. We're actually drinking the February beer. Although these are spring beers in the alternate universe of beer seasons, there is still snow in the mountains, a nip in the air, but not today, and it's cold. So the February beer is Mountain Daisy IPA. We brew this beer with an eye towards the return of the flowers to the mountains as the snow begins to melt and the eternal power of spring flexes her muscles. And there's a quote from Jack Handy. Before you criticize someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes. That way, when you criticize them, you are a mile away from them and you have their shoes.
Oh, Jack Handy.
Speaking of which, I was at Deception Pass yesterday, taking in another beautiful early spring day.
Yes.
And do you know what I found there?
I don't.
A pair of shoes.
Oh my God.
And I took them home.
Wait, really?
I found a pair of shoes at Deception Pass.
Very similar shoes
to this Jack Handy quote. I said there were some shoes that had been abandoned. I was like, I like those shoes. Do they fit me? And they fit me. And so I took them and I wore them today. And I'm going to take them to South by Southwest because they were comfortable.
How do you know they were abandoned? Like, what if someone was just walking along the beach or wherever you were? And
someone put up a sign that says lost shoes.
Free shoes. here was my reasoning. They were kind of out of the way, like near the actual bridge, Deception Pass Bridge. Right. And I looked on the bottom of them to see if there was anything that I should be aware of. Right. And any unfortunate substances on the bottom of the shoe, whatever that might be. And there were like roly poly bugs going around on the bottom of the shoe.
What else might that be besides dog poop?
I don't know. It could have been anything.
Gum?
You never know.
Anything that was an obstacle in the speedwalker sketches on Almost Live.
Yeah, it would have really slowed down the speedwalking. But so I looked on the bottom, and there were roly-poly bugs on the bottom of the shoes. And I mean, I just figured that meant that they'd been there for a while.
Wow. That's a logical deduction. I'll give you that.
I'll show you the shoes later.
I'm just not okay with any of this. I'm going to be on the record.
They're very, very comfortable, and it kind of fits with the theme of this beer.
It does. That is a convenient thing. All right, so one more point of business before we get to this week's business. We are requesting from you, the listener, to share with us your favorite moments, interviews, conversations, whatever it is, from the history of the Pelton cast. All the way back to the beginning, back in 2013, whatever you can think of, we would love to hear from you on Twitter at PeltonCast or, as always, PeltonCast@gmail.com for a special feature coming soon. Mm.
Every moment tied for the worst.
There was that 1 week we didn't record a podcast.
Great stuff.
Got top-notch reviews that week. 5 stars all around. Okay, let's get to, we've teased it, the famous Cousin Katie's trip to LA this weekend to see Isaiah Thomas and the Lakers against the hated rival Cavaliers.
Oh, yes. It was spectacular. I wanted to get into, before I started that, just talking a little bit about why it's so important that I follow Isaiah Thomas.
Oh, your Isaiah Thomas credentials.
Yes. So, you know, this all stems from the Sonics leaving us, being stolen.
And everything comes back to that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So after they were stolen, you have three major options. You can either just boycott the NBA, which I'm not mentally strong enough to do. And I think you, Kevin, have to.
It's not really an option
for me. Have you considered boycotting the NBA?
You know, if you talk to many people online, I don't watch NBA games. So perhaps I asked
you, you have boycotted the NBA. You just look at spreadsheets.
That's right. And then the second option would be to follow the Blazers because of their proximity to Seattle, which...
Someone in this podcast has begun referring to the Blazers as we within the past week.
It isn't Katie.
It's okay. Not me. Definitely.
I want to talk about my Blazers in a second.
Oh no.
I mean, I think this would be a good. Okay. Oh, you're gonna talk about them, how they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And then the third option, which is obviously the preferred option, is to follow the careers of former UW players
which
across
would have led
the NBA.
You to the Blazers.
Yeah, what the hell?
No. Wasn't it first Nate Robinson?
I suppose that's true.
And I followed him to the Knicks, where I believe he had a great block against Yao Ming. Anybody remember that?
We did kind of like the Knicks for a little while that year.
Nate Robinson, yeah.
Was, I mean, he had some exciting plays.
Yeah.
And then you have Brandon Roy come in, play for the Blazers. And aside from just having exciting plays, he was also a very efficient and good player and became an all-star and was exciting to watch.
All these things happened, by the way, before the Sonics left. He was an all-star the year of the Sonics.
Okay, okay. I guess that's true.
We're just rewriting history over here.
And then let's see. And then so following after Brandon Roy is Isaiah Thomas, 60th pick in the draft, last pick. And then he goes to the Kings, where I had to watch him fight for minutes against Jimmer Fredette, who is not in the league anymore. Finally, you know, making it to the Celtics, where they go to the Eastern Conference Finals. And he becomes an all-star as well. And then to see him get traded to the Cavs and then only get, 15 games to play?
15 games.
And the narrative turns into he's washed and a cancer and the sole reason that the Cavs were bad.
LeBron wrote all of those headlines himself.
All of that kind of leads up into why this game was so important for...
I mean... I like to throw around the term revenge game a lot on Twitter because it's fun when it's, you know, there was some talk tonight in your Blazers game about Shabazz Napier going up against the Heat.
Shabazz revenge game.
But this was a real motherfucking
revenge game.
This was a revenge game. And we just happened, makes me sound bad, but we were in LA for a funeral. And so I managed to see if there was a game that happened to be there at the same time, and it was the potential revenge game. So we got tickets, went down there, and it started out not so great.
It was a rough first half for Isaiah.
Yeah, for a second I thought he wasn't even going to play because he wasn't on the bench, because he's taken to warming up in the tunnel by sitting on the exercise bike to keep his legs fresh. So I had a panic attack at the beginning of the game, like, we're not even going to see him play. And then, you know, he has a rough start, misses his first few shots, but then gets a few assists. And the Lakers are in the game. That's all you can really ask for. And then second half, he turns it on, starts making some shots, getting some dimes, and talking a lot of shit to the Cavs bench, which I love to see. behind me, there are these two guys, and they were basically what I call the in real life version of the Reddit RNBA thread.
So you're saying they did a lot of complaining about me?
I don't know if they mentioned you specifically.
I wish that they knew who you were.
There's been a lot of comments on Reddit lately. Many comments on my Blake Griffin and Carmelo Anthony comparison in the mailbag on Sunday. Anyways.
It was mostly about how short Isaiah Thomas was and that sort of thing. And
you should be impressed with Isaiah Thomas for being short. This is not a thing to contend with.
Also,
you should be insulting people for being tall.
Here's the thing. Isaiah Thomas is not actually that short. The average American male is 5'9". Isaiah Thomas is listed at 5'9". I don't know. I don't know if I've ever gone...
I feel like you have to adjust this for basketball players.
No, but that makes... Well, why would you have to adjust it? Like, he's not actually short. Muggsy Bogues was legitimately a short person at 5'3". That's like a short American adult
male. How
tall
are these people complaining about him?
Oh, not tall. Not tall. Yeah. Just regular dudes.
I should just be out impressed.
Making fun of Isaiah Thomas.
When I see Isaiah Thomas playing basketball, I think to myself, I could be in the NBA.
Since I beat you one-on-one in one of the three games we played on Saturday, I assure you...
One of the four games.
Okay, one of the four. I assure you that is not the case.
Uh-huh. I was going soft so I didn't injure you a bit, because I knew the kind of complaining that we would hear about after that.
I'm finally starting to heal. It's only been 5 weeks.
God.
Michael Bennett is now an Eagle.
You're really nursing that injury.
It happened on the day of the Super Bowl, and somehow Michael Bennett is on the Eagles now.
Yeah, checks out. All right, anyways, back to the game.
You can just talk
so there was a girl up ahead of like in the nosebleeds. We were in the nosebleeds, but she was in the very last row, who was what I would call like the best version of myself. And she was completely drunk and just totally yelling out, just cheering for Isaiah, just slandering LeBron James whenever he touched the ball or did something bad, which wasn't actually that frequently, but she found her, you know, ends there. And she was the most enjoyable part of the game, probably.
So with Isaiah playing a huge role, the Lakers go on a 17-2 run in the third quarter of this game, turning what had been a close game into a rout. Isaiah finishes in 31 minutes with 20 points, 9 assists, 5 turnovers, but a plus 18 in his 31 minutes of action in a game the Lakers won by 14, meaning they were outscored by 4 with him on the bench.
Yeah, so Isaiah basically won that entire game all by himself.
That's what I'm going with.
Randall didn't have anything to do with it.
Really, really quiet 36, 14, quiet, yes. 7.
You think that it's a terrible performance.
Look.
An outside the top 25 performance of Julius Randle.
Small sample size.
What was the general climate of the game? Are the fans in LA, are they excited about Isaiah Thomas?
No, they like cheered when he came out the first time, but then like, no.
They are so in love with their young players.
Oh yeah, they love the young core.
Have no room in their hearts for Isaiah Thomas.
Yeah, no room. I mean, they were happy when they were winning and Isaiah was scoring, but it wasn't like when he went and sat down, he didn't get the kind of cheers in the end of the fourth like other players
got. He's only been there for a few weeks, but it feels to me like Isaiah Thomas is like the perfect Lakers player to me.
In what sense? Like,
in that he's small and he's feisty and he's a little bit aggressive. He's got like a chip on his shoulder. He's a Lakers player.
I have been wondering lately, like, if the Lakers don't get LeBron this summer and they just ran it back, like they tried to re-sign everyone to big one-year contracts or something like that, they could do with Kentavious Caldwell-Pope because they could give him a small raise over this year's big one-year contract. And then both Lopez and Isaiah Thomas, they have full bird rights on, so they could do that. Like, would this be a 50-win team next year? Because they've been playing like it since the All-Star break.
50-win team, wow.
I mean, they had a stretch where they, like, lost 9 in a row, but nobody was playing like they were.
Before Isaiah
Thomas. Pre-Isaiah Thomas, yes. Very important asterisk there.
We consider it in the pre-IT era, yes, and the post-IT era.
Much different team.
I divide all of human history into those periods myself.
So you've really embraced the Lakers.
Oh, they're a great team to watch. They're exciting. They push the ball in transition. You know, they have Lonzo Ball. So I'm actually such a dedicated Lakers fan that I've now watched all of the episodes of the Facebook show Ball in the Family.
Wow. Okay.
Except for the newest one that just came out.
We're going to start reviewing it like Ballers on HBO.
Oh,
no. That's what I should change the name to, is Ball in the Family on HBO. Okay. Are there any highlights from Ball in the Family?
Not really.
No, that doesn't sound like a great watch.
No highlights.
That's not, I mean, it's just so strong review.
LeVar being LeVar, which, you know, it's entertaining.
Question for you. How thrilled were you when Kobe won an Oscar?
He's a lifelong Lakers
fan. A little bit of a mixed, you know, a mixed bag there for me.
The current climate?
Yeah, you know, things that have happened in the past. Yeah.
You stood and applauded at home, but you felt a little bit uncomfortable about it? So, you very much embraced the Lakers. To me, we need to talk about the food that you had in LA also.
I have some takes on the food. Well, let me talk
about the Blazers first. Sorry, let me talk about my Blazers first.
It's obnoxious.
Because the Lakers have been playing well.
7-2 since they got Isaiah Thomas.
There's only one team.
No, that's not true. 7-2 since the All-Star break.
That is undefeated since the All-Star break, including wins over the Golden State Warriors, over the Isaiah Thomas-led Lakers in their house. It has been Lillard time every single game. This Blazers team, fifth best record in the league, third in the West, not exactly pushing 1-2 in the West yet, but they are a real threat in the playoffs.
To do what in the playoffs?
To win it all.
Oh, God.
We are talking about
this. Let's remain calm here.
Spirit of 77 is happening in Portland. The dream of the 90s is not alive in Portland. The dream of the 70s is alive in Portland right this second.
I mean, it could be the dream of 91.
They didn't win in 91.
It wasn't even 91. It was 90 and 92. I got the one year they didn't
win in 92.
See, this is what I don't understand. Yeah. How can you be this high on someone who's not the Sonics?
Like, the Sonics existed then. You can't call the Blazers we during Sonics, periods where the Sonics
don't exist anymore. Those championships that we won, that championship that we won in 77 was amazing. I still celebrate Bill Walton to this day as a lifelong Blazers fan. Love every single time he announces a game.
I mean, we all celebrate Bill Walton. That's just because he's part of the human, right?
I celebrate him for bringing Luke Walton into our lives.
Siring Luke Walton.
Great point.
But it makes the argument that you're making about you just cheer for Isaiah Thomas wherever he goes. I would make the same argument about Brandon Roy in that there was somebody who was there for us, a team that was there for us, when the Sonics moved the very next year. Brandon Roy was waiting for us as a superstar in Seattle with the Huskies and a star in Portland, and that ushered in my Blazers fandom. And he's the one who kind of he begat this era. He was the Bill Walton to Luke Walton of this era of Blazers basketball. He sired Damian Lillard. All of these people. Brandon Roy made the Blazers good, and they have been good more or less every single season since Brandon Roy got there.
Yes, that's generally true. Plus also Mr. Sonic, when the Sonics moved. Mr. Sonic was the head coach of the Blazers at the time, so that was also a natural transition.
I'm talking about the guy waving the rally towel at Sonics games. I'm like, Sonic, you just cheer for the Blazers all of a sudden.
I mean, I do admit it was fun being a Blazers fan during that stretch. It was fun to go down to Portland, which we still do. Still go to Portland.
Still fun to go to Portland.
Still fun to go to Portland. Anytime. And, oh, that's what something I wanted to talk about, is the food in the Staples Center versus the food in the Moda Center.
Okay.
Yeah, not great.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. Not great. But I didn't do any pre-research. I didn't do my pre-game work. You know, I didn't scout, so we just kind of had to go in there cold.
You didn't research contracts for 10 to 12 hours like Richard Sherman?
No one's that dedicated.
I might spend 10 to 12 hours at Yelp before going to place.
Like, I just thought of how disappointed Tristan would have been with me if I hadn't Yelped all the places first and found the optimal selection.
Oh, obviously. I heard some good things about chicken in the Staples Center. They gave us vouchers to use during the All-Star game at the concession stands. That's in lieu of providing food to the media. But because of the fact that the games were so early, I just planned to eat afterwards. The only thing I ever had there was, like, I had some caramel popcorn to tide
me
over during
the All-Star
game. But they
don't have real LA restaurants in the Staples Center?
No, not really.
Well, I mean, apparently they have like a taqueria that used to be outside of Staples Center that does like churros. I found afterwards doing this research.
I did see some churros. Yeah, they looked good.
Not make a food experience though.
Well, those chicken sandwiches, we walked by the place and passed it. And so I'm really doubting myself now because we ended up having pizza, which...
It was just stadium pizza though?
No, it was like a fancy pizza, like wood fire, I think. You know,
but it has
technically
to be a real
wood
location.
Fire.
I'm telling you, this is the best development that's happened in sports in the last 20 years, is having real restaurants that you would go to when you weren't in a stadium, in a stadium.
100% agree.
Yeah. So that is a definite plus.
You shouldn't even play the games.
That the...
I agree.
Just go there to eat.
He wouldn't watch anyway. It doesn't matter. They should just give you food and spreadsheets. That's what a whole stadium should be.
And then beer afterwards. Yeah. The Blazers are doing it right.
What would the spreadsheets have on them?
just stats for the game.
Just
I'm
numbers?
Just getting the box score from the game. It doesn't matter. I'm just not watching
it. The game happens Italian soccer style with no fans.
No.
Okay.
How about outside the Staples Center? What did you have to eat on this trip?
Okay, so we did get to have two burritos, which we'll probably talk more about burritos later.
Let's get into it right now.
Okay, and so we had, first we had a burrito at some place, I think it was called Los Arcos in Oxnard, California, which you will probably never go to, but that's
hometown
where
hometown of former Mariner closer Bobby Ayala. Oxnard, California.
How do you know that?
A lot of baseball cards growing up.
Okay.
Saw that a lot of times. More on the 90s Mariners coming later in the pod.
Oh, really?
Exciting.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, I'm going to be surprised.
Clearly, no one has read the notes.
Oh, no, I've read the notes, and I'm excited for it.
Okay, good.
Okay. But I had a chili relleno burrito. I don't know if anybody's ever had that before.
Interesting.
But basically, they stick a, what kind of pepper is it? A poblano pepper filled with mozzarella cheese inside of the burrito. And I think there's also like rice and onions and beans in it. And it was delicious.
So I've never had a chili relleno, but now that I'm a veteran of eating,
you think spicy you can handle
peppers,
this?
I may try it sometime.
Is it that hot?
No, the poblano is not.
It has
hot.
To be so much less hot than whatever you've been.
Completely. I mean, if you get a little bit of heat, which is nice because it goes really well with the mozzarella, which is kind of like a, I think it's mozzarella, some sort of cheese like that. That's kind of like very. Oozing out and gooey. It's just like perfect. Mm-hmm. And then the thing, you know, people always talk about how California has good burritos and in comparison to Washington. And like the thing that I noticed about this burrito was the tortilla was just so delicious, better than anything I've had up here. And it just, I don't know, it was perfect and like soft and it was really, really good.
Yeah, I would say the tortillas are usually better. And then the thing that to me really separated the mission style burritos that I've had that are generally considered the best burritos in the world is like the evenness of the ingredients. You don't have one bite that's like all whatever the meat is and then one bite that's all, you know, sour cream or something like that or cheese or whatever, beans. Like everything is all together in each bite.
How is that done? What's the difference?
I mean, it's just care in how you're positioning the ingredients, I would say.
Okay.
All right, anyways, the other burrito you had.
So we went back. We've been there before, but it was so good. We went there a second time instead of trying a new place. We went to Allen B's, which is just a small little, like I guess it would be a burrito place. They serve other things on the east side, I believe, of LA. And their like main thing there that you have to get is the bean and cheese burrito. And they take like... beans and refried beans and cheese. I think it's just like cheddar cheese. And then they put either green or red salsa, not salsa, but hot sauce in there. And it's delicious. It's very simple, but for some reason it's very good.
So this is one of the locations that was in the 538 burrito bracket and therefore is a place that I have intended to get to, have not managed to get there any of my trips to LA in the past year, but at some point I inevitably will. So I think we've maybe talked about this on the podcast before. It's hard to like conceive of a really amazing bean burrito because our experience of bean burritos is so driven like by Taco Bell.
Oh, I say freezer burrito.
That too. Yeah.
I mean, that's when, like, honestly, the picture kind of looked like a freezer bean burrito,
but
like a really good version of that.
A really good version of that.
Yeah. It's delicious. It's just,
and they're small, so you can like order multiple of them, right?
I mean, I could only eat one and a half of them. I got the red and the green, and I could only eat one half, but my husband was able to easily eat two of them and be fine with it. But I would like to try some other stuff there next time and like vary it, but it's hard to break away from the, you know,
I mean, there's so much good food in LA.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of burritos in LA.
I mean, I think I've cracked one of the four burritos from the burrito bracket in LA proper, as well as a couple of the ones that were in Orange County. So still plenty of work to go there.
I was going to say it's only like 15 minutes away from the Staples Center. So
if
you go back, you got to go.
It's unacceptable that I haven't done it yet.
I fully agree that it's unacceptable.
But so, while we're on the topic.
And I want to say, speaking of simplicity, right?
Yeah. Okay.
We're going to be talking about Tacos Chuggies, the first contender in our search for... We need to come up with a name of it, because Seattle's Best Burrito / Taco doesn't work. Should we just say Seattle's Best Taco?
I don't know. I feel like it started as Seattle's Best Burrito.
I don't know. I wanted it to be Seattle's Best Burrito, too. But there were so many naysayers.
Both are eligible. So, as we've described before, Tacos Chuggies is essentially the incumbent here. It's the belt holder right now. And we're looking to find out whether any place else in Seattle does either better tacos or better burritos than Tacos Chuggies, because we think they are number one at both.
Wow.
So we went there on Saturday.
Mm. The first time ever. I haven't been there like 8 times in the last 2 weeks.
It was my first time at the Beacon Hill location, which is relatively new.
What do you think about that?
I liked it. I mean, I thought it had been advertised as having a patio.
Oh, did I say that?
I don't know.
I mean, you could take your food and like go
sit outside.
Yeah,
there's like a plaza outside, but there's no tables.
It would be super nice if it had a patio there, because there is the plaza. Like they could.
Especially on Saturday when it was a gorgeous 60 degrees at that point. I was very into the idea of sitting on a patio and eating tacos, Chuki's, and drinking, in my case, the Chuki's house beer that they have made for them by Mollusk Brewing. Big fan.
It's good?
Yeah, it's like a quality Mexican lager style beer. In Tristan's case, two Tecates.
And then followed by a lot of Tecates since then.
But there was a lot of both tacos and burritos that we consumed there and debated how many you could possibly consume at most.
I said I could eat five of each, which was a bit of an exaggeration.
Wait, hold on. Let's break that down. Five tacos and five burritos at the same time?
Yes. Yeah, no, I could not. Okay. I could not do that.
We both ended up going with three tacos and two burritos as our order.
So is you that, did no, actually eat that?
No. Collectively, we ate it.
But not, this is your theoretical orders.
Yeah.
Okay.
As the most. We each had two tacos and two burritos, right?
No. We started. Did we?
Oh, and you ran it back and got a third burrito, and I went back and got a third taco?
I ran it back, and I originally had three tacos and one burrito, and then got the second burrito. You originally had two and two, and then got
and the then third got taco. The third taco? Okay.
We ended up in the same place.
I think I could have eaten one more item, though. I could have eaten six total items.
My standard order there is two tacos and one burrito, and we had just played basketball, aforementioned, so I decided, I'll go for it. Three tacos, one burrito. And then it was so good that I had to get the extra burrito. And I don't know if that was a great decision in the long run, but it was a great decision in the short run.
It was a great decision in every run. Anytime you're running it back, it's always great.
All right, here's the first question we should ask.
Okay.
Which is better, the Tacos Chuki's House Taco or the Baby Burrito with adobada, which is kind of their specialty meat?
Katie, do you want to start?
Well, I think everyone knows where I stand on this, or just the listener, I guess. But I think, of course, that the house taco is the best because you're getting more items in it than you're getting in the burrito. You're getting tastes that complement each other better than you're getting in the burrito. So you're going to get the meat. It's an adobada, right? And then you get I think there's cheese on the house taco, but I'm
cheese.
Not sure about that. And then it's kind of light, though. It's not like a lot of cheese. It's not like you're like really making it, you know, Americanizing it.
It's almost like mixed in with the meat.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then you get like some sort of green sauce on there. I don't know what that guacamole is.
Apparently they mix mayo in there.
Did you read on their Twitter?
I did read that on their Twitter.
Oh, God, I didn't know that.
Vegans, beware if you're going to Tacos Chuki's for some reason.
So to me, it's more akin to like the crema sauce that you get.
Because it's not super spicy. It's just kind of, it gives a little bit of flavor, but it's not too much.
Oh, and plenty of flavor.
Then you're topping it off with the thing that really
Is there also some salsa on there?
Red sauce, too.
Oh, red sauce. With the thing that makes it all work, which is the pineapple.
A slice of pineapple.
Because that really works well with the pork. And the two flavors there, the kind of sweet and savory, work really well with each other.
Yeah, so traditional al pastor, I think my understanding of how it works is you'll shave off the pork and then the pineapple together and have those kind of all mixed together.
They've got the pineapple on the bottom, if you notice the pork.
They do, but they don't mix them together necessarily. You're getting all meat and then the separate pineapple.
And the meat is so good.
It's so good. And that's the case for the burrito. It's the fact that you're just getting a lot of meat in that burrito.
My favorite burritos, the burrito that I had at La Pasadita in Chicago, right, which is a burrito I expected nothing from. And then I had this burrito and it changed my life from that moment forward.
You did not realize that you were eating a 538 burrito bracket burrito.
I honestly didn't. I didn't even know that I liked burritos at that point. I didn't even know that I liked food before that meal. And then I had that burrito and it changed everything. And that's the way that I feel about the Tacos Chuki's baby burrito, right? Because the tortilla is so soft and fluffy. It's gooey. It's fresh. I love everything about it. I like the tortilla more than I like
those are also tortillas.
But it's
hate to break it to you.
It's different.
It is, yes.
And the burrito, it's soft and gooey. And in the tortilla, I don't know, it's like a corn tortilla, a flour tortilla.
Do you know the difference?
It's a flour tortilla. But then
the burrito is definitely
meat.
A flour tortilla.
It's just meat and onions packed in there. That's it. You're getting it condensed, just the meat, and it's so delicious. And it's gooey, right? There's just like sauce dripping out of it. Everything, every bite is amazing. And you get this explosion of flavor coming from it, and it's condensed, and the shell is so good from the burrito. Look, the taco's amazing.
And yet you said all this, and you ordered more tacos than burritos.
Oh, wow. Case closed.
That was in that moment. Today, I had two burritos and one taco.
Okay.
Because I went back there today. So most often, obviously, I'm getting more burritos than I am taco. But the thing is, we live in an amazing world. This right here is the good place, because we can have both. We don't need to decide between the two. We can have on the same plate together, living in perfect harmony, tacos and burritos, each of which are the best in Seattle.
Baseball Prospectus used to have an analogy because they were upset that people were saying it was stats versus scouting back in the Moneyball days. And they were like, no, it's like beer and tacos. You don't have to choose. You get to have both beer and tacos. And I think that's pretty much what you're saying.
Third thing.
That is the third thing.
I had that also.
Of course.
The perfect order is two tacos, two burritos, and two tecates.
Wow. That's a lot.
Dos acero. I would say that my verdict is I lean slightly on the side of the taco, but I agree with you that they're both amazing and that they are both the best
exactly.
in Seattle.
I'm not anti-taco. I love the taco.
I'm not anti-burrito for all the talk I talked.
I feel like we might need to shake hands.
I don't know if I can do that.
I don't want to shake hands with you after you've touched somebody else's shoes.
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh my God.
Do we have a rating for the tacos, Chukis? I guess combining both the taco and the burrito, or I guess whichever is your favorite, the rating should be based on is the way we should do this. Do we have a rating?
Is there a curve for Seattle? Like
no curve.
I would say no, yes. So I'm going to rate La Taqueria like 100 on this scale.
Okay.
And that Tacos Chukis is going to be relative to that.
I'm very inexperienced outside of the Seattle area, so I'm.
Why did you ask?
I still know there's still some good stuff out there from what I have
tried.
You know,
you're aware.
I mean, you're Mr. International.
It's a known unknown.
Mr. I'll go with 95. I feel like I go with 95 for everything.
I was going to go with 95 also. So I've had the place that I'm going later this week is where I had, the La Posadita versus this. It's a different experience. That maybe let's say La Posadita is the best burrito that I've ever had. And in Austin, Texas, at Vera Cruz All Natural Food Truck is where I've had the best tacos I've ever had.
Those are some damn good tacos.
And I think those are like a 98. Tacos Chukis is good. It doesn't quite reach those heights, though. Like, I could eat the Vera Cruz tacos. They have all sorts of different types. They have breakfast tacos. They've got everything. I could eat those at any time of day and think they were amazing 100% of the time. Tacos Chukis is excellent, but it's not quite at the level of Vera Cruz. I think
they were great 95% of the time. Is that what you're saying? I was going to go with a 94. So we're all in the same ballpark here on Tacos Chukis. And it's going to set the bar very high for coming taco and burrito options. And again, if you have suggestions, we've gotten some great ones so far. Please keep those coming at PeltonCast on Twitter or PeltonCast@gmail.com.
So next week, I think we should try from South Park. Not the South Park food truck, taco truck that we've eaten at many times, but a new location.
Not Loretta's that I ate at earlier today.
I don't. They might have tacos for lunch. Nobody knows.
It is possible.
You guys will claim they're the best ever, probably.
I want to try the tacos or burrito at the, how do you pronounce this? Ambiquity?
I really don't know, because it doesn't seem like a very Mexican word.
Never heard of that
place. I'm gonna call it Ambiquity Cochina Mexicana in South Park.
Yeah, this is a relatively new restaurant along the main drag in South Park, right down the street from the aforementioned Loretta's. We had this one time for lunch, and I think we both enjoyed it.
I would say to me, look, it's a perfect 5 stars on Yelp.
It's
right
interesting.
Now.
You went with the tacos that time, and I think I went with the burrito, is my recollection.
Wow. Not exactly staying in form.
Well, that is just specific to Tacos Chukis. In general, I prefer burritos to tacos.
But this is a newcomer to the taco and burrito world, and I feel like an instant contender.
Interesting.
It's exciting to have something that you haven't probably had too much, where it's like a lot of the other competitors, like we're talking about like gorditos or something, you know, not that excited by.
Does gorditos still exist?
I don't know. Super old.
I'm pretty sure gorditos does not still exist. I suppose I have ways of checking that. I thought you were going to go with like...
It looks like it does exist.
Does it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I've not been there in like a decade. Yeah. So I'm very curious to try it again, actually. The baby-sized burritos. I mean, I don't know that most of the locations on here are that familiar to us. I think we'll be trying a lot of new things in the course of this.
That's exciting, then.
We'll be making new friends and keeping the old, because one is silver and the other is gold. All right, on that note, should we talk about sports?
All right.
Not that we haven't talked about sports previously. I guess Seattle sports. A quick update on the NBA NHL front. Not much news on the NHL side, but an interesting report from Chris Daniels of King 5 last week that Chris Hansen's investment group has bought yet more land in the Soto area, a 10,000 square foot parcel of land along First Avenue South, currently home to Jimmy John's and other businesses. It's south of the proposed arena location across the street. The investment group now owns 13 acres in Soto, having spent more than $125 million on real estate in the area.
On nothing. Do you think that maybe Chris Hansen is just like a really astute businessman and is just like realizes that this property is going to increase in value whether there's a team or not?
So I think that's a solid plan B. The thought that Soto is going to be the new South Lake Union in terms of being opened up to development as Seattle continues its transition from being an industrial center to more of a 21st century location. But I still think his primary goal is to build an arena there and that this would be part of the LA lifestyle complex around it. Do you have any thoughts on LA Live having been there this weekend?
Speaking of LA Live, yeah. Whew, I mean, it's cool, but it's not cool at the same time. You know what I'm saying?
There's not a lot of like great like authentic local restaurants there. I mean, they are local.
They're bringing in the stuff at New York in like Times Square that you don't want to eat at, like a Guy Fieri restaurant. It's not actually there, but it's like kind of that big
physically upset here
corporate. You know, branded stuff that's not that exciting to go to. But coming out of the game after a win and all the people are kind of milling about in this big square and some of these places had like outdoor bars and places where people were still celebrating, you can kind of continue the evening. It was really exciting.
Interesting. Two things here, by the way. Number one, LA Live, the brainchild of Tim Leiwicki.
Oh,
who developed Staples Center while he was at AEG. Number two, I don't think it would be identical, whatever the Hansen Group would build if they build this arena to what's at LA Live, because it would have a Seattle feel as opposed to an LA feel
A
2018 feel as opposed to, you know, this started to spring up. The Staples Center opened, I believe, in 1999. LA Live was a couple years after that. But it is an interesting area. What I like about it is the fact that the ESPN offices in LA are directly across the street from the Staples Center. There was a funny story that gets told about our podcast producer, Andrew Hahn, on the Hoop Collective. Who
you're talking about the Pelton cast.
No. You don't know
about the producer that we have?
I'm the producer. So one day he and Brian Windhorst of ESPN are in the office around, you know, right before a Lakers game. And he's like, you know, I feel like I'm going to get some soft serve ice cream. And Windhorst is like, where are you going to go? He's like, over to the Staples Center media room. Because you could just walk there in like 5 minutes and come back. And it was like nothing.
That sounds like a very specific benefit for ESPN employees.
Potentially true. But is I am an ESPN employee, a good benefit nonetheless. Okay.
But on Chris Hansen. So Chris Hansen's still lurking.
Yeah.
He's not going
anywhere.
I thought he was going to give up, kind of.
I think the two arenas situation is still a very real possibility. Like, if Chris Hansen manages to buy an NBA team, do you think the city council is going to be like, no, we're good. We've got the NHL. We're good.
I don't know. Sometimes the city council does things that make me think that they would be like that.
A lot of the NHL city council's objection was to the idea of, why are we going to authorize you to build this arena when you don't even have a team and we never know when you're going to get a team? So if Chris Hansen goes to them with a team, it becomes a different situation entirely.
When it feels like Jenny Durkin has been especially supportive also.
Yeah. I mean, she's consistently maintained that a two-arena solution is possible.
And I mean, look, the fact that he bought this land means that he thinks there's a chance.
I don't know if it necessarily means that because, as you point out, there's a solid plan B of just holding this real estate.
But you can buy other real estate. Accrues. Like it's not a coincidence that this is real estate that is attached to the other real estate that he owns.
Yes. I mean, the more you can control in the same area, the better. I mean, we saw that. We learned that with Paul Allen and Vulcan in South Lake Union. But Yeah, I do think it's consistent with continuing to intend to build an arena.
This is a good sign.
So when you say get a team, does that mean like get a team by buying it from someone else, or does that mean expansion? Is it possible to?
As we've discussed repeatedly, I don't think expansion is happening anytime.
They probably wouldn't expand to Chris Hansen without an arena.
That's what I'm saying. Like, that would be a weird situation.
Yeah, it would be there's a sort of chicken or egg problem there. But no, when I talk about that, I mean him going out and buying a team in another city.
And that we still think is a possibility?
I mean, I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow, but it's a possibility. Yeah.
And there are teams who may be sold.
There are teams that may be sold. Yes. We've discussed them on the podcast ad nauseum. Memphis and New Orleans are the teams that are potential candidates.
I thought something just happened with one of them, though. Like, their owner got worse or better or something.
Tom Benson, the owner of the Pelicans, who is 90 years old, wasn't hospitalized recently, I believe with the flu.
But he's not. This is all horrible that I'm thinking about it in these terms. But I read it on Twitter, so I think that makes it okay.
Who's on the Lakers Reddit?
Yes, flu-like symptoms. He is of the most recent update, which was last week. He remains hospitalized, but has shown signs of improvement, is in stable condition. So,
all right. Well, this is still good news for the NBA to Seattle. It's mild, but good news.
Yeah, I suppose. All right, let's talk about the Seattle Sounders. And a toast to the Sounders for winning their first leg against Chivas 1-0 last Wednesday at home at CenturyLink Field.
Katie, note that Katie is pained in her toast here.
It looked like
this. Mad that we're not talking about Hope Solo right now.
It looked like this could be a scoreless draw, despite the fact that the Sounders, I think, generally had the better of play in this match against the visiting Chivas. But then in the relatively late stages, they get a Clint Dempsey goal that was a huge one to get
very
that home.
Important Clint Dempsey goal.
Yeah, because you don't want to go into Guadalajara needing a victory in the second leg, which will be this Wednesday at 7 p.m. on Univision. The history of MLS teams in Mexico, not great. The Sounders are 1-4-1 in Mexico all time, having beaten Monterrey 1-0 in 2012 as they advanced to the quarterfinals of the CONCACAF Champions League. However, they have only lost by two goals or more twice, so that gives them, I think, a chance in this game. It's also notable that Alan Pulido, Chivas' lead striker, will be on yellow card suspension for this game and will miss it. So that's good news for the Sounders.
I mean, winning and not giving up a goal is such a huge deal in these matches.
It's, yes. I mean, I think the thing that you often see in these matches is when MLS teams win, it's because of the fact that they win by multiple goals at home. So that would have been a lot better. I mean, I think that 1-0 win at home is kind of like a median outcome for the Sounders in terms of what you were hoping for here. But I think the key to this match is going to be, can the Sounders get a goal on the road?
Yes. If they get a goal, the whole game has changed.
Yeah, because then Chivas needs three goals to advance. So that's a pretty big deal. So.
Yeah, and we've discussed Chivas sitting near the bottom of the, what do they call it? What is this particular table?
Let's see here.
This is the Liga MX.
I believe this is the Clausura.
The Clausura.
It's closing. The Apertura in the fall is the opening.
You know why I like following other sports than soccer?
Because you have to learn from Spanish.
All this, no, just like all these other, like, there's all these things in soccer, like supporter shield and all these different competitions that are going on.
Do you want
at
us
the
to get
time?
Into allocation money again?
No, dear God.
It was a good week for the MLS teams against Liga MX. In addition to the Sounders, we mentioned last week that the New York Red Bulls went into Tijuana and won 2-0. I think that was unclear when we discussed
Lakers
it
fan
podcast.
Over here talking about championships. All she cares about is rings. How many of them do you have? No.
Toronto FC also won at home last week against the Liga MX side. So the MLS, I think, with a real chance to prove it's like competing on level terms now with Liga MX.
Katie was excited about the LAFC victory that happened in Seattle.
We actually learned about that there was an LAFC team from a guy in the airport.
You didn't listen to the podcast? We discussed
maybe not
it repeatedly.
That portion of the podcast. But I was like, you're talking about the galaxy, right?
Oh, no.
The guy in the airport was like, no. The team owned by Magic Johnson, which I think.
There's many owners. Magic Johnson.
It's terrible Lakers fan.
Yeah.
You should have been very up on LAFC already.
Tom Penn, former Blazers assistant GM. So you're very familiar with Tom Penn.
Huge fan. Tom Penn's involved with that?
He is. He's the team president, too.
Oh, wow. Yeah, he's very involved. The Warriors are also involved, right?
Yes. Rick Welts, their president, is involved. And then Kirk Lacob, the son of the owner who works in the front office. So, yeah. There you go. There's your LAFC upset. All right, back to the Sounders.
This is an LA podcast just for Katie.
Because next year I'm going to hate everything
LA.
What
are the Dodgers doing in training camp? What are the Dodgers doing in spring training?
What team is Isaiah going to... We're going to be like a Mavericks podcast next year.
Magic? I don't
Knicks.
Know.
Maybe Knicks.
Oh, wow.
All right. I could finally wear my Starburys again, which, by the way, you tweeted about, and I think you were like, does anybody else wear these? And I'm pretty sure the answer was definitively no.
Yeah, it did appear that was the case.
Yeah, I'm literally the only one. I'm going to be at South by Southwest hooping in Starburys, and I might get made fun of.
Or somebody else's shoes.
Those are the two options. Somebody else's Pumas or my Starburys. It's either like 15-year-old Starburys or shoes I found on the ground.
Oh, boy.
Those are the two shoes that I'm legit. Those are the two shoes I'm going to bring to Texas.
Sure they are. Good for you. So as I was saying, Kelvin Leerdam was a full participant at training on Sunday. It looks like he has a chance to be back for this game in Mexico this week. However, midfielder Victor Rodriguez suffered a setback, and it looks like he's going to be out a while longer. Sounders also should get back Magnus Wolf Eichram, who missed the first leg with a knee contusion.
Huge.
So the Sounders will also play an MLS match this weekend on Sunday at FC Dallas, who comes into this game ranked 14th in the MLS in 538 Soccer Power Index, having drawn 1-1 with Real Salt Lake at home in their opener. So a chance for the Sounders to get a result on the road, I think. Although, again, the focus remains on this matchup with Chivas and advancing in the CONCACAF Champions League rather than these MLS seasons early in the interminable MLS schedule.
Got to get that one in.
Got to check that bingo score. All right, let's talk about the Seahawks, who, in a huge move at cornerback, released Deshaun Shedd on Monday. This is essentially a favor to Deshaun Shedd after his contract tolled from 2017 due to the time he missed coming back from his ACL injury. The Seahawks had promised Shedd that he would become a free agent this year, have a chance to explore free agency, so releasing him allows him to do this. They still hope to re-sign him, although he is apparently scheduled to meet with the Detroit Lions, who did not sign Richard Sherman. We're among the many teams that did not sign Richard Sherman. The Seahawks also, in news Monday, re-signed Bradley McDougal to a three-year deal worth a reported $14 million, according to NFL.com's Mike Garofolo. This was important, certainly, with Cam Chancellor's future uncertain, and with Delano Hill and Tedrick Thompson not proving as rookies that they're capable of contributing.
I love the signing. I mean, of all the moves the Seahawks have made this offseason, this is somehow my favorite.
I mean, I guess I don't know what else would be your favorite. What's number two?
Releasing Richard Sherman. I don't know. Releasing Deshaun Shedd. Like, there are not a lot of great options here.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a pretty easy pick.
That second round tender for Justin Coleman is a pretty solid move.
Yeah.
But I mean, getting Bradley McDougal back on a solid contract, he was a good safety last year.
I think we all felt strongly that McDougal would be back after he played so well on last year's one-year contract. Just with the uncertainty at that position, his ability to play both free and strong safety, having played both those spots last year, it was, I think, imperative for the Seahawks to keep him.
And he's coming back at good money. And honestly, the chances of Cam Chancellor being a starter for the Seahawks next year are pretty slim. And the chances of Bradley McDougal being there as the starter at safety, at strong safety from day one, are very high.
I mean, obviously the complaint among Seahawks fans is the fact that you invested two mid-round draft picks last year in the safety position and still needed to re-sign McDougal. It's not great. That's not a great use of resources. But those picks are sunk costs. Just because of the fact that you used a high pick on Delano Hill doesn't mean you can throw him out there next year as a starting strong safety.
Look, maybe Delano Hill beats out Bradley McDougal at some point and we're happy with that situation.
I mean, then we probably wouldn't. I mean, we don't know the structure. The other thing is we don't know the structure of this contract. If we've learned anything about NFL contracts that was reproven with Sherman's contract, it is that you cannot look at the years and the dollars that is the maximum.
Yes.
Because there's so much more going on with NFL contracts.
Don't even look at it for the first few days because it's going to get reported incorrectly.
Exactly. Not incorrectly, but it's going to be incomplete.
You just guaranteed money is all that matters.
Yes. Not all that matters, but it's the main thing that matters. As you mentioned, the Seahawks have tendered restricted free agent Justin Coleman at a second round level. That guarantees him a $2.9 million deal for next season if he chooses to accept the tender. If another team comes in with an offer sheet to him as a restricted free agent and the Seahawks decline to match, then that team would also have to send the Seahawks a second round pick. That is pretty obviously not going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think that's happening. But Justin Coleman could be the Seahawks starting nickel corner next year.
I think he is the favorite right now, with Jeremy Lane also being released. I mean, first off, the Seahawks have a lot of corners on the roster because there's Mike Tyson and what, DeAndre Elliott, is that his name?
That seems about right. Is Nico Thorpe still on the team?
I think so. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, they both were.
I mean, there was an incident, right?
Yeah.
So they've got some. They've got
very players. Nice. Very nice to the people in the city of Renton, by the way.
Do we know that's a Rentonite?
Yeah, we can. We can.
Did it happen in Renton? Is what I'm saying.
Yes. It looked like it did.
It definitely happened outside the practice facility. Yeah. That much was clear. Not a great representative of Seahawks fans. Much like that one person that burned a Richard Sherman jersey. That's what I was
saying. We can transition to talking about Sherman. It's like one person burns their jersey, and like if you're the like Richard Sherman sees this one person, is like, people are out there burning their jerseys.
Like I understand it if you're Sherman. And first off, one person is one person too many to burn a Richard Sherman jersey.
Like there's one dumb person in every situation.
It's performative at this point. Like people are just doing it for the likes.
Yes.
What that lady did wasn't performative, though.
That was decidedly not performative. And again,
there should be nobody doing that.
There should be no one doing it. But let's not draw sweeping conclusions about Seahawks fans from it or anything.
I'm still disappointed.
I agree. I am also disappointed.
Can we draw conclusions about Rentonites from it?
we still don't know.
Residents of the greater Puget Sound.
Could be from Shoreline or somewhere. Everett?
These are not places that are that close to Renton. These are very far from Renton.
I think it's more in Bellevue.
I would have gone with Kent.
that's a good one. Yeah, they're from Kent. Definitively.
All right, quickly in terms of the business, the Seahawks also tendered restricted free agents Mike Davis, Deion Jordan, Dewey McDonald, and Thomas Rawls at lower levels. Those guys will probably all be back next year. Deion Jordan being, I would say, the most important of them, is potentially a starting defensive end with the Michael Bennett trade.
Yeah, Deion Jordan, I'm a little bit surprised, wasn't tendered higher.
All right, so Richard Sherman. Mm-hmm. We talked on Friday. We had an emergency podcast about the Seahawks releasing him. A day later, we got the news that he had decided to sign with the San Francisco 49ers. And many people were not excited about this, I would say. Many 12s. Our takes, I think, are pretty cool on this one.
We don't know Katie's. Like, maybe Katie's takes are hot.
I feel like I always am like the idiot on the podcast, so I'm going to just take that role here.
No, go for it.
I thought it was Voice of the People.
Voice of the People.
Okay, so your guys' take, right, is that we shouldn't be that upset that he signed with the 49ers.
Yep.
Like, I mean, I'm beyond not that upset.
Okay, cut him. It's literally
okay. I think you have to separate the fact. It's one thing for him to sign with the 49ers, right? And that's fine. He can do that. That's in his best interests. And it's another thing just to be sad about like what you're losing.
Oh, no,
and to
course.
Say it's going in to one of our rivals.
Yeah, yeah.
And so like, I think you can be emotional. It's okay to be emotional about the thing about him being gone and being sad about that.
Yeah, it's just about whether you should be upset at Sherman.
I didn't see that much from like at least most of the Seahawks Twitter I follow about being upset at Sherman.
Can I confess something?
What?
I don't think Richard Sherman's going to be very good at football next year.
This is kind of my take also. But also, I actually, this might be too hot of a take. I'm happy that Richard Sherman is going to the 49ers because we'll see him more next year than we would otherwise.
So like if he'd gone to the Lions, like he would just be in like, some
let's
anonymous
say, let's
player.
Say he signed with the Dolphins, right? They're not in play, but let's say he signed with a team like that. Right? If you sign with the Dolphins, with the Jets, with the Bills, look, any NFC you've seen that's not the Patriots. If you sign with the Bengals, there are so many teams that are just nameless, faceless teams. But to us, the 49ers, we play them twice. We see them on TV all the time. If Richard Sherman's good, we're going to see a lot of Richard Sherman, and that would be fun.
But what
think
if,
about how much happier we would have been. Sorry.
I don't know. That actually may not be that fun.
Think about how much good. Happier we would have been.
Yeah, what if Jimmy G is good? What if the 49ers are actually good? And then Sherman comes in here.
And pushes them over the top.
Then yes. Fuck it. we have to compete. That's what this is about. Oh, we should want competition. Look at my Blazers.
Oh, we love being
in a conference with the Warriors and the Rockets. We want the competition.
All right, settle down, Dave.
If the Raiders would have been good last year and we could have seen Marshawn Lynch in the playoffs, wouldn't we have loved every single second of that?
Yeah.
Isn't it the same thing with Richard Sherman? Do we hate seeing Richard Sherman be successful?
Can I give you a quote from Win Forever that I put in the notes this week for this moment? My opponents are not my enemies. My opponents are the people who offer me the opportunity to succeed. The tougher my opponents, the more they present me with an opportunity to live up to my full potential.
Kirk Cousins.
And play my best.
Sign in Arizona. That's what we want.
Bring it on!
We want Russ. We want Goff. We want Cousins. And we want Jimmy G in the NFC West.
I want none of this.
Bring it on.
I'm actually going to opt out of this.
We don't want to limp our way to the playoffs. Let's get in there. But the thing is, I'm not afraid of the 49ers. I don't care about the 49ers. Richard Sherman is not going to take the 49ers from being a bad team to being a good team or vice versa. The 49ers will be what they're going to be. Richard Sherman's just going to be along for the ride.
Should we talk about Sherman's contract? So originally reported at 3 years and up to $39 million. We learned a lot more about that.
Ridiculously reported.
So the way it works is he got a $3 million signing bonus. He is also guaranteed $2 million base salary this year. He will get a $2 million roster bonus if he's on the roster on the first day of training camp, which barring some sort of legal issue, completely unforeseen legal issue or some sort of setback with his recovery, he will be. So he'll get that $2 million probably. $2 million in roster bonuses for being on the 46-man roster each week, similar to the Seahawks had with several players last year. A $1 million incentive for playing time, and then a $3 million Pro Bowl incentive that also, if he makes the Pro Bowl, will guarantee $16 million of his 2019 and 2020 money. Otherwise, this looks a lot like a one-year deal worth $10 million if he's healthy. Then that jumps to he'd get $13 million this season if he was, in fact, to make the Pro Bowl, which is more than he was set to make this year in Seattle with an $11 million base salary. Thoughts on this?
It's hard because, I hate the contract for the player because there's basically no guaranteed money. But at the same time, if he had just signed a one-year, $9 million, $11 million deal, we probably would have said, okay, that kind of makes sense.
I actually thought he was going to get much less than that. I mean, obviously, the Seahawks were trying to get him to take a pay cut from that $11 million and perhaps a sizable one. So I think this is a better contract for him than he could have got. I mean, obviously, it's a better contract than he could have gotten elsewhere because he went, as we know from Peter King's article on the Monday Morning
Quarterback. This is entirely true. If I can make an argument here, people were talking about the only thing that I felt when reading that Peter King thing was that agents are important.
Why?
Agents are important because they would have contacted every single team.
You don't think that he contacted every single team?
We don't know necessarily. And they have relationships.
He talked about the teams that were most interested in him.
First off, there's a difference between a player contacting a team and an agent contacting a team. It's a very different situation.
I don't buy that.
Players don't have leverage. Agents have leverage. Agents have other players to leverage their players.
I mean, yes, it's harder to screw an agent because of the fact that they can come back with you with some other player and come back to haunt you.
Richard Sherman just has Richard Sherman. And also, players are much more likely to believe in themselves than agents are to believe in a player.
That's true.
I mean, that's probably true. I agree with that.
Agents believe in guaranteed money.
But do the agents overestimate guaranteed money because it guarantees that they're going to get paid? I mean, I don't think that agents' incentives are in line with player incentives.
Sure. Get what you can get and not have to worry about it evaporating later.
But look, I mean, there's every time a player acts as his own agent, which almost exclusively seems to happen with former Seahawks.
It's Pete Carroll just builds up this culture, and the Seahawks never benefit from it. Right? Have they ever negotiated with a player aside from Richard Sherman calling them, John Schneider being that's too expensive for us, and then hanging up?
I mean, I think they negotiated with Okung as well, but he decided to go elsewhere.
It just would be nice if the Seahawks could benefit from this one.
But there's this weird rush by everyone to say, oh, terrible contract, should have had an agent. Look, you know why Richard Sherman got a terrible contract? Because Richard Sherman is 30 years old and coming off an Achilles injury and just got it released. That's why he got a bad contract. Because is evident in the Peter King story. He gave the Seahawks the opportunity to match this contract, and they declined it. They said, Schneider reportedly told him, the incentives are a little rich for me. And the Lions said something similar.
The Seahawks probably just, they were ready to move on from Sherman at this point, unless it was at a very low dollar amount.
Well, why would they have asked for the right to Madge if they didn't have any interest in bringing it back?
Because they wanted to know. Look, just if he went out and got $5 million, it's a different situation than him getting what looks like maybe $9, maybe $11
million. So isn't that by definition a good contract for Richard Sherman? Well, haven't you just argued against your own point?
For this 1 year, but there's the year after that and the year after
that. But he's coming off an injury. No one is going to guarantee him a lot of money for future years.
He's coming off an injury. It's very hard to tell.
Is this microphone working?
What Richard Sherman's
value is.
Are other people hearing me?
That's why no one's going to pay him for more than 1 year. And if he plays well next year, he'll get a long-term contract. And if he doesn't, he won't.
I mean, I more or less agree with that.
So, moral of the story, don't get injured when you're 30 and in the last year of your contract. That's my recommendation, too.
I think that an agent could have gotten him multiple years with obviously more guaranteed money.
I don't think so.
You think this was the best deal he could have possibly gotten?
I mean, first off, best is a relative term because there's a million things that come into play. Where do you want to live? Are you interested in taking some risk? Like, you've made a lot of money in your career. Do you want to settle for the sure thing that might give you less money, but might give you more money? Like, best is a very relative term.
Are you vengeful?
Are you vengeful? Excellent point.
That's other agents also aren't vengeful. Agents just see money.
Agents are working for players. And that's something that I think people often forget. And I think agents are wildly overrated.
Do you understand you're speaking to an agent?
Agents are wildly overrated. This is insane.
Like, did that occur to you during this entire argument?
I don't think that the musical group that Tristan deals with are spending 10 to 12 hours reading other bands' contracts.
Maybe they're going to start.
It's not as publicly available.
If a band was offered a deal, if somebody went to the band themselves and they were worth tickets or whatever, they are much, and the promoter was like, you guys are worth tickets. We have skin in the game. You have skin in the game. Everybody wins. They are much more likely to believe in that, right? They're like, we bought into ourselves, right? We're worth tickets. We can do this. Like, they believe in themselves. But an agent 100% of the time will look for the most guaranteed money possible because sometimes you don't sell tickets. That's the name of the game. Like, sometimes it doesn't happen. What if Richard Sherman gets hurt at the beginning of next year? What if Richard Sherman is hurt before training camp happens? What if his injury doesn't heal the way he expects it to? All of a sudden, what has he gotten? $3 million and that's it.
I think his $2 million base is guaranteed. So he'd get $5 million.
They couldn't release him?
But it's guaranteed.
It is guaranteed?
I mean, that's my understanding of it.
Okay, so then he gets $5 million. I'm just saying, there are a lot of things can happen.
And do you think the Seahawks were offering him more than $5 million this year?
I don't think the Seahawks were offering him more than $5 million. Then what are we doing here?
I think
Team X could have been offering him more than $5 million. And you're spending more time. I think you're making a lot of assumptions.
And why we would criticize someone based on not understanding the situation.
The assumption that I'm making is that spending 10 to 12 hours reviewing contracts versus a person who deals with contracts every single day for years is not an equitable thing. Saying like, oh, this person's research, he spent 1 day looking at contracts versus a person who deals in contracts. Katie knows this as a lawyer. As a contract lawyer, as a person who spends every single day working on contracts, especially the ins and outs of contracts and guaranteed money, like an NFL GM does, means that they're
going... John Lynch, that 1 year he's got as a GM.
Oh.
So do you think John Lynch was a bad GM last year because he didn't have experience as a GM?
I think he probably had smart people around him. Let's say your boy Magic Johnson aligns himself with a former
agent.
A former what in Rob Pelinka has pulled every single string correctly because he knows what
to do. Oh, really? Was the tampering string pulled correctly?
That tampering was bullshit. Are you kidding me? We've got our Lakers over here. You want to tell me about tampering? God damn it. That was the most bullshit tampering that has ever happened.
I think it was tampering, and I wanted to continue to be tampering because I don't want LeBron to go to the Lakers.
That's the worst thing that could happen for Katie. And now the truth comes out. Lifelong Lakers fan.
Ridiculous tampering. You know that it was. All you said was like, LeBron James is a good player and we'd love to have him here.
I don't mean that quote. I mean when Rob Pelinka called Paul George's agent and talked to him on the phone.
Oh,
that tampering.
He can't call an agent and talk to them on the phone?
Apparently he can't.
What if he was talking to him about another client?
Apparently he wasn't, because they fined them.
Look, when Paul George is a Laker this summer, you're not going to come back to me and talk about this tampering. What do they have to give up?
You know what? But again, he would. You know why he's going to go to the Lakers if he goes to the Lakers? Because they're in L.A., not because of Rob Pelinka.
Rob Pelinka's a genius.
This is great man theory over here. Can we talk about the Mariners?
Pro agent theory. Wait, we don't have any other Seahawks talk. That's it.
I mean, do you want to talk about free agency, which opens? I mean, teams can now negotiate and players can commit. Is apparently Case Keenum has committed to the Broncos. Contracts cannot be officially signed until Wednesday. Do you have some Dominican Sue takes after he got released by the Dolphins?
My takes are that if we're not willing to pay Sheldon Richardson and we're not willing to pay Michael Bennett and we're not willing to pay Richard Sherman, which makes a little bit more sense because of the injuries, why would they be willing to pay Ndamukong Suh?
Because he might take less money. I mean, everything is relative.
Sure. Okay. In the
do you want to get into the DeMarco world, Murray thing that Ben B and I got into on Twitter
fight
today?
Your first real fight?
YouTube. I didn't actually see this at all. Are you pro DeMarco Murray?
I'm pro bringing him in for a visit.
You're off the podcast.
I was going to ask if you were like pro kicking the tires on Eddie Lacy again.
Eddie Lacy, Jonathan Stewart.
I don't think Eddie Lacy was the problem last year. I've been very clear about this.
He's not
the solution.
The
offensive line is the problem.
It doesn't matter if Eddie Lacy is the problem. A minimum running back could have done what Eddie Lacy did.
I mean, that's probably
anybody
true.
Can run for negative 3 yards.
How do you know that Eddie Lacy is not going to be a minimum running back right now?
I mean, he probably is, but it doesn't matter. I'd rather have a young minimum running back than Eddie Lacy. What is Chris Carson making as a 7th round draft pick?
I mean, yeah, we're going to have Chris Carson on the roster. I don't think that's the question.
Why
it's
do we
who else
need
is going
Lacy,
to the roster?
Why do we need anybody else?
You're just going to have Chris Carson as your only running back coming off of a severe injury? That's an interesting choice you've made.
Oh, come on.
I assume you'll also have J.D. McKissick at least.
Yeah, we got J.D. McKissick. CJ's coming back.
Oh, yeah. The real durable backfield you've got there.
I'm just saying there are players like J.D. McKissick. There are players like Chris Carson out there for free, basically.
You don't
need to sign a veteran running back.
DeMarco Murray was a very good running back 2 years ago.
Behind the Tennessee offensive line.
It's true. But again, all running backs are a product of their offensive line. So it doesn't matter which running back you choose as long as you don't pay them a lot of money or invest a high draft
pick.
But
is there a chance we're going to get someone of that high caliber of a name for nothing? Like, is that going to happen?
I mean, probably not, but you never know.
The minimum
again,
versus the rookie minimum is too much for DeMarco Murray.
Fine. Whatever. I don't think it would be a bad thing to sign DeMarco Murray for the minimum. That's my bold take today. I guess I'm going off on crazy pills that DeMarco Murray have got $10 million a year like 3 years ago. Giving him the minimum would be an okay decision.
He's not going to make the minimum, though. But DeMarco Murray is going to make more.
But it doesn't hurt to talk to him.
Okay, fine.
It doesn't
talk
cost
to
anything
Whatever.
To talk to him.
No, I totally agree.
They should probably talk to his agent.
Yeah, they should. I always say anytime you can get an offer, you should get an offer. Because you never know what the offer is going to be. And you can look at a lot of those.
This is one of those fights that, like, you guys talk about as being, like, pointless off-season stuff. Like, you're fighting about, like, just, like...
Oh, but this is the kind of fight we've been having for 30 years. When did Tristan start talking? Yeah, about 30 years.
Okay. You should get an offer 100% of the time, right? They should talk to DeMarco Murray. They should kick the tires on every single free agent.
That's what I'm saying.
I mean, I suppose I agree with that. But where do we stand on ASJ?
It seems likely that the tight end market is going to be pretty hot based on the Cameron Brait deal with Tampa Bay.
God,
6 years,
Cameron
41
Brait
million.
Deal.
So I'm not gung-ho about signing any tight ends as free agents at this point. I'd rather address that position in the draft, I think.
I would love it. To be honest,
SJ. Any Husky.
Yeah.
You were upset the Seahawks didn't trade for Danny Shelton last week.
Oh, man.
Was he good last year? Let me look at
ASJ?
ASJ?
DVOA. It turns out he was the worst tight end in the NFL by DVOA.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, he was the worst tight end in the NFL by DR. Yeah, they should not sign ASJ. I had not looked at that. I didn't realize. I think fantasy football clouded people on him.
Well, I think also the fact that he was playing with the Jets quarterbacks
sure.
is a factor in
the I mean, DR. If the Jets quarterbacks are the difference between being the worst tight end in the NFL and being a competent tight end.
His track record in Tampa Bay was not ideal either.
He has some other things going on there, though, right? And he's cleaned up on those things.
Apparently. Yep.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
ASJ supporter here.
I mean, I still, look, if they got him for low money, I still would be for it.
But I don't think they are going to get him for low money.
So. I mean, Jimmy Graham was also not great Oh, 9th by DR, but 28th by DVOA. Huh.
Well, this has been Tristan Reads the Football Outsiders on DVOA tables.
They should really try to sign R. Gronkowski. Do you think he's out there?
Do you think he'd play for the veteran minimum?
Oh, man. Cameron Brate actually was good, though. That's the difference between Cameron Brate and Jimmy Graham.
It's just a lot of money for Cameron Brate, especially when you drafted O.J. Howard in the first round a year ago.
O.J. Howard was also good. Maybe they should have just let him play.
Two tight end sets. All right. All right. We'll go with it. All right. Anything else on the Seahawks front?
Is there any other position? Because it feels to me like if the Seahawks are unwilling to spend money on the players that are already on their team, why do you spend money on an expensive veteran free agent?
Well, what are you just, you're rolling all this cap space over? You're rolling $38 million in cap space over to 2019? That's your plan?
They have $38 million in cap space at this point? And so they're just going to blow it on Ndamukong Suh?
Well, who are we going to throw out there?
I mean, first off, they have, at this point, they have like five defensive linemen, which I think they're going to need some more than that going into the season.
God, if only Michael Bennett were out there. It's not a pretty good deal. Wouldn't be too hard to get. So they have $38 million in cap space, a lot of that coming from Richard Sherman. And where's going to be the replacement at cornerback? Are they going to find that in free agency?
I mean, I think they're probably, my anticipation is that they, first off, is the difficulty they've had bringing in outside players at cornerback. My anticipation is that they will go with Griffin on one side and then a competition between if they can re-sign Shedd and then Byron Maxwell on the other side with Coleman again on the slot.
All right.
And I guess if you count the tender to Coleman, they are now at significantly less than $38 million in cap space.
I mean, I guess the main thing is with free agency, I would want them, especially if it's not a young player, if it's somebody who likes you, to commit to a Sherman-like deal where...
Well, yeah, of course. But, you know, Ndamukong Suh, while he had a relatively disappointing 2017 season, he didn't rupture his Achilles.
Also has an agent. Somebody who they're going to hypothetically be able to commit. Like those one-year deals that they had last year, in a lot of ways worked. They were able to sign Bradley McDougal and see what he could do and then bring him back at a pretty good number.
But wouldn't it have been better if they had signed him to a two-year deal at like maybe like $7 million? Because that would still be less than you're paying him now, right?
They could have done that, sure. But if they could bring somebody in on a short-term deal, one-year, two-year deal, and not a ton of money, and it's different for a player that's making the kind of money that Sue would be making. So if they bring him in for a one-year deal, then I might be okay with that idea.
Okay.
It's not going to happen, but I would be okay with it.
I'm okay for signing players for less money than they're worth. That's my theory.
Sure.
And so the specific player almost doesn't matter. It's all about the contract.
No matter the position, quarterback, running back, any player for less than they're worth.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of free agent quarterbacks going for less than they're worth. These
Case Keenum signed, you know, all things considered a pretty good deal. Maybe the Seahawks should have brought him in.
Look, at least kick the tires. All right, on that note, let's talk about the Mariners.
Oh, God.
And let's talk about how incredibly old we are. Because the Mariners last week signed a journeyman minor leaguer to a minor league contract. And that minor leaguer was Bo Amaral, the son of 90s Mariner and my all-time favorite Mariner, Rich Amaral.
Journeyman minor leaguer, Rich Amaral.
So Bo Amaral is 27 and has yet to reach the majors, but that's okay. Because his dad didn't make the majors until age 29 and didn't stick until his age 31 season, during which he finished 5th in Rookie of the Year voting.
Wow, he is like carbon copy of Rich Amaral.
I mean, I don't know that you can just necessarily say that because of the fact that Rich Amaral played, I want to say 6 full years in the majors after age 31, that Bo Amaral is going to do the same thing. That's kind of an unlikely outcome.
So if Bo Amaral actually makes it to the Mariners and starts playing well, it's going to be like your Isaiah Thomas, right? You're going to be like...
I'll be interested in the Mariners.
You're so interested in the Mariners. You'll be reading whatever the Mariners...
USS Mariners?
Our Mariners.
Our Mariners.
I was very excited. I learned about this from our elementary school friend, Michael Bernazzani,
Michael Bernazzani pointed this out to you?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So,
shouts to Michael Bernazzani.
An exciting development.
You think he's ever listened to this podcast?
I don't know. Very few people do. All right. Don't think anything else to add there. Let's get to UW Sports. Football has added a fourth commit to the 2019 recruiting class, a offensive lineman from Diablo Valley College, Corey Luciano, who will have 2 years of eligibility. And that's pretty much all there is to say.
Always excited about a lineman signing.
Yeah, you.
I'm like you with the kicking the tires. If the Seahawks sign like 15 offensive linemen, I'd be like, pretty solid move.
Did you watch the huddle on this guy?
No.
It's pretty impressive. I mean, I don't know, no idea who he's playing against, but he's just like pushing people over and like pushing them 15 feet back.
All right, now I'm very curious to find out the Diablo Valley college schedule.
You don't want to watch this clip, just the schedule for Diablo.
Of course.
Doesn't even want to watch the games. All checks out.
It really does. Okay, they played Chabot.
Sequoias. Look, Chabot's got some good players.
Wait, Father River. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed American River. San Joaquin Delta.
A lot of rivers in the
San Francisco. De Anza.
You know San Francisco's good.
Santa Rosa.
We only lost well,
at the housing De Anza, prices there.
De Anza shouts to Black Trey. At Contra Costa.
What does Black Trey have to do with De Anza?
He played there. San Mateo wow. And at Modesto.
Was he a defensive lineman?
You know, he was a point guard. He was a point guard.
How many of those would Luca know?
not a one of them. San Francisco, maybe.
Yeah. The Dons?
The Dons, yeah.
That's the same San Francisco.
I would guess so. I don't know. Maybe not.
I'm going to have to teach him American River College's nickname.
All right, UW softball went 4-0 in the Rebel Classic to move to 27-0 on the season. They did need 10 innings to beat New Mexico State 3-2 on Saturday. They will host Bryant University on Wednesday in the final non-conference game before visiting Arizona State this weekend to open up Pac-12 play. ASU comes in 21-2, having lost to Oklahoma, of course, the winner of last year's Women's College World Series, and Tennessee. And we close with Husky men's basketball, which was teased earlier, received a bid to the NIT. Merely snuck in is a 5 seed for the NIT, but will host the opening round against Boise State because of the fact that Boise's home arena, the Taco Bell Arena, is busy hosting the NCAA tournament in Arizona and Kentucky this weekend.
That's what this Mike Hopkins Coach of the Year season is about, hosting an NIT game because the other team's home arena, the Taco Bell Arena, is hosting an NCAA tournament game.
Look, compared to the expectations coming into the season, getting into the NIT is a huge win for the Huskies.
Did the Huskies do anything last year?
In terms of postseason?
Yeah, did they go anywhere?
Last year? I don't think we would have gone anywhere.
They didn't go, I mean, aren't there a lot of tournaments, right?
But if you're like a Pac-12 team, can't just play in...
how many tournaments do you think
the
there are?
College Insider Tournament.
Is there more than the CBI?
Yeah, there's at least four now.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There might have been a fifth that sprung up last year that played in like Vegas. I can't remember.
Okay, so I'm not that far off.
I didn't know about any.
Five tournaments.
But you don't play in them. Those are for mid-majors. Pac-12 teams that go 2-16 in conference don't play in those tournaments.
Okay. Saying this, not far off from the type of season in the end that...
Oh, wow. This is an awfully me-take-your delivery in here.
Maybe the future is pointed in a good direction, which it may have been either way.
It is pointed in a good direction, all things considered.
I'm just saying that if you were to take this season with the final schedule, etc., and especially being a 5th seed in the NIT in the end, this is we thought that we had a chance to go to the NCAA tournament as of like 2 weeks ago.
But you can't face that. Oh, no. First off, that tells us how far the Huskies were from making the NCAA tournament in the end. Number one. But number two, you can't reset expectations based on the middle of the season, based on some things that may not have been sustainable that the Huskies were doing during the course of the season.
That didn't actually bear out.
It didn't?
No.
They were still good at
three-point defense. What was the three-point percentage in the game they lost?
Three-point defense was still good. Their offense just sucked.
Pac-12. It was like 28% or something like that. It wasn't great. They lost because...
I mean, they were also playing one of the worst shooting teams in the Pac-12. You're right. The Oregon State shot 23% on threes in that one. But nonetheless, the Husky success proved unsustainable late in the season.
I mean, maybe we got a little bit too excited about like Dominic Green being a...
Oh, God.
Real player.
It's a fall from grace.
We'll always have the shot he made against Arizona.
And he'll always have that. It's good for him.
In what was Lorenzo Romar's only trip to UW... as a member of the Arizona coaching staff, because on Monday he was named the head coach of Pepperdine, the school at which he started his coaching career before moving on to St. Louis and then to UW. So congrats to Coach Romar for that.
He's going to have Pepperdine balling.
I mean, he's got this campus in Malibu, considered by all accounts the most beautiful campus in college basketball. And if it's more beautiful than Loyola Marymount's campus, then it must be stunning.
Loyola Marymount is the one that I had the map above my ceiling, right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
I don't know how any campus could be more beautiful than UW's.
Yeah.
In the springtime.
You can't see the ocean from UW.
Halfway joking.
I know. Just wait till you've seen the Taco Bell Arena in the springtime.
Also, did you guys see Bill Simmons' tweets where he's like trying to become a Pepperdine booster?
Yeah, what is he
saying? I don't understand that. What's Lorenzo? What's going on there?
I don't understand the genesis of this either, but I am enjoying it.
I liked it too. I feel like he might have talked a lot of shit about Lorenzo last year, and especially like...
I don't think Bill Simmons cares that much enough about college basketball.
He talked about Markel Fultz's coaching and like the UW team with Markel Fultz last year.
Might not have been accurate about last year's team specifically.
But I think he talked a lot of shit about the coaching that Markel got and the team, and especially the offense that the Huskies ran last year. So all of a sudden he's in on Lorenzo?
I mean, I think it's, you know, there's a different level at the West Coast Conference.
Look, my feelings about Lorenzo very wildly also. So although they've come full circle to me being very excited to see him as the Pepperdine head coach and thinking that he's going to lead this Pepperdine team to the NCAA tournaments.
It's going to be interesting to see whether UW schedules Pepperdine.
They have to, right? We've got to play Pepperdine.
I don't know. It'll be very interesting. Very interesting. All right. Anyway, let's talk about Boise State a little bit. They went 10-2 in non-conference play, including a win at Oregon, finished second in the Mountain West at 13-5, but were upset by Utah State in the quarterfinals of the Mountain West tournament, snuffing out their NCAA tournament hopes as we had a bid thief in the Mountain West in the form of San Diego State. The Broncos rank 42nd in the country in adjusted defensive efficiency. They have the best defensive rebound percentage in the nation at over 82 or at almost 82%, have allowed just 33% shooting from 3-point range this season, but they rank 297th in the country in forcing turnovers. Offensively, they're an excellent shooting team. They're making 38% of their own threes. More than 40% of all shot attempts come from three. This is an offense that's built around NBA prospect Chandler Hutchison, who is a 6'7" wing. He's excellent on the defensive glass. He's not a great shooter, but he serves as the creator from the wing. He has the 11th highest usage rate in the country, and he sets up three other starters who shoot better than 40% from three or better, led by Justinian Jessup at 47%. Also, center Zach Caney will be a problem on the offensive glass. I'm curious to see how Boise State matches up here, but my expectation is that they'll use Hutchison sort of as their version of Trace Tinkle, try to float him at the high post against the zone a lot. So that all sounds very problematic.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it's going to be good for us.
No.
The Huskies are going to lose.
I mean, here's the thing about the NIT. The NIT is almost all about motivation. So if Boise State is unhappy that they lost early in the conference tournament and that they're playing in the NIT and they're not even getting to play at home because of the fact that they've been kicked out by the first round of the NCAA tournament, then that could work to UW's advantage in this one.
Anyway, I think they're going to be angry that that situation is happening and take that out on UW.
The nice thing about it is that either of those scenarios is equally plausible.
I think some of the UW players are actually upset that they didn't get selected to the NCAA tournament, so maybe we have our own motivation.
Yeah, I mean, that's always tough. I think it's the hardest for the teams that are like the one seeds in the NIT because you're like, we should be in the NCAA tournament, and like you're just so bummed about not being in the NCAA tournament that you end up playing poorly. But it's always fascinating to watch from that standpoint. Are people excited about the NIT at all? Oh, that's a hard no from Tristan. He's such a no that he's unwilling to even speak into the microphone to exclaim it.
I think what will be interesting to see is people are talking like, well, me, we're trending up.
Right.
And if we do kind of like what we've done before and just kind of fizzle out here, well, we already fizzled out, but fizzle out in postseason play, that won't be a great sign for next year. So I want to see us really try hard and to try to look like we're improving and to give a positive sign for next year.
I mean, certainly the Huskies have beaten much better teams than Boise State at home, you know, both Arizona State and Arizona. So it's not like it's something that's inconceivable, but I think that they are probably slight underdogs in this game, despite having home court. So we shall see. We'll be back next week to discuss that, to discuss Tristan's trip to Austin and plenty more, I'm sure. On that note, thanks for joining us, Katie, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.